Tops, he liked nothing more than to do it one more time before he died. Chapter 18. Islamabad, Pakistan. Umar Shirani, Pakistan's Army Chief of Staff, unlocked the cabinet and pulled out a bottle of gin. The kitchen lights are off, but the illumination filtering in from the hallway created a dim reflection in the window over the sink. At 71, he was still a bull of a man. An expanding waist was evident behind the casual slacks and golf shirt, but so were the thick arms, barrel chest, and broad shoulders. The scar acquired in the 1971 war with India was still visible, a puckered line that started on his right temple and disappeared into his thick mustache. Saad Chutani had no such scar, nor did that pathetic fool Ahmed Taj. They were nothing more than useless bureaucrats, bookkeepers whose talents were limited to flattery, intrigue, and speechmaking. They had never fought for their country. They would never shed a single drop of blood for Pakistan. All they could do was maneuver in the shadows, quietly chipping away at men greater than themselves. Shirani put the glass to his mouth and felt the rare sensation of alcohol burning his throat. Allah had put a great hurdle in front of his loyal servant. He would understand. The aging soldier exited the kitchen and started for his study. The house was nearly 10,000 square feet, decorated and redecorated countless times by his young wife. The wildly expensive furniture and art had recently turned modern, and while he despised it, he knew it wouldn't last more than a few years. Soon she would use U.S. dollars meant for fighting terrorism to create a new theme. The house seemed unusually quiet as he strode through it. His wife had wisely withdrawn to the east wing. She'd learned to read her husband's moods and knew that her presence would only create a convenient target for his rage. But where were his security men? Had they too retreated in the face of his anger? Sometimes he thought the younger generation consisted of nothing but pampered cowards. How was his country to survive when he was surrounded by nothing but traitors and weaklings? Men like Saad Chutani and Ahmed Taj. Shirani could not dispute that the president was a skillful politician. His ousting of the formidable former ISI director in favor of Taj was a first step toward bringing the powerful intelligence agency to heel. Underestimating Chutani's abilities would be extremely dangerous, but overestimating them could lead to paralysis. While in some ways impressive, nothing the politician had accomplished would have been possible without the constant involvement of the Americans. The critical difference between Shirani and Chutani was that the president actually believed in America. He genuinely treated his leaders as friends and partners. He took their money like they all did, but instead of subverting it, he used it on Washington-sanctioned programs. It was all part of his twisted dream of turning Pakistan into a U.S. clone, into a place where Shirani's daughters would be free to behave like prostitutes and Allah would become a quaint mythology. Chutani was dangerous, but also far too impressed with himself. While he had been successful in infiltrating Pakistan's intelligence apparatus and bribing the poor with public projects, his position was not unassailable. His American-sponsored drone attacks and commando raids had strengthened Pakistan's growing fundamentalist insurgency, and he was not the master of the army. Not yet. The truth was that Pakistan had been controlled by a civilian government for too long. The country had a lengthy history of coups, and the undeniable fact was that Pakistan performed better under military rule. The time had come to act. Shirani climbed the stairs, lost in thought, but by the time he reached the top landing, the continued silence began to intrude. The army provided numerous servants and guards, men he'd handpicked for their skill and loyalty. While the size of his home had the ability to obscure them, it was unheard of for him to travel its full length without at least a glimpse of the people tasked with keeping his household operating. Shirani felt a dull surge of adrenaline. Had he underestimated Chutani? Had the politician managed to defeat his security? Was he looking to do something more tangible than just humiliating the commander of his army? Shirani slowed, staying on the carpet runners as he continued toward the back of the house. The overhead fixtures had been removed in the last remodel, leaving the hallway lit only by weak, widely spaced lamps. He told himself he was being paranoid, that Chutani didn't have the courage to do something this overt. But it did little to steady his nerves. He put his drink down on a low chest and opened one of the drawers. Inside he found one of the many guns that had been strategically placed around the house. The mechanism was well oiled, and the round entering the chamber made almost no sound at all. Shirani found himself wanting to call out, to discover that his men were just giving him space. He wasn't confident enough to do so, though. Instead, he crept forward, taking a deep breath before stepping into his study with the Heckler & Koch P-7 stretched out in front of him.
"I hardly think that will be necessary,"
Ahmed Taj said in Urdu. He was sitting near the unlit fireplace, legs crossed and hands steepled in front of him. Like at the end of the last meeting, he refused to avert his eyes.
"Where are my men?" "I wanted to speak privately."
"How?" Shirani started, but then fell silent. While Taj was still dressed in his familiar rumpled suit and faded tie, he seemed completely transformed. His posture was ramrod straight, and his normally dull eyes had turned cunning. Was it possible that everything Shirani knew about the man was a lie? The realization that he had seen only what Taj wanted him to see came like a blow to the chest. It seemed so clear now, the increasing sophistication of Taliban activity, Durrani's death, the well-coordinated attacks on the army's nuclear facilities. How had he been so blind? Taj calmly pointed to the weapon in Shirani's hand.
"Put the gun down and sit, Umar. We both know that if I wanted you dead, you would have been long ago."
Taj watched the man as he laid his firearm on an ugly western table and sat. Umar Shirani was in many ways his polar opposite. The general was a creature of privilege, having been born into a wealthy family with strong ties to the military. It was this that had made him complacent and all too easy to undermine. In the end, men like him possessed a fundamental belief in their own superiority. To them, life was a competition they couldn't lose, an endless game of jockeying for position in an entitled hierarchy.
"First, let me apologize for the army being relieved of its duties guarding our nuclear arsenal. It was certainly not my intention."
It was a lie that Shirani would immediately see through. The goal was less to convince the army commander that the ISI had no interest in reigning over Pakistan's missile capability than to set a civil tone. Taj needed an ally, not another competitor.
"Of course," Shirani responded noncommittally.
He looked around him, undoubtedly out of a futile hope that he wasn't alone, that his men would enter and help the old soldier retain the upper hand he was too arrogant to realize he'd lost years ago.
"Our country is rotting, Umar, from both inside and out. The regional instability caused by the Americans is spreading. Sectarian violence has grown to a point that it's at the edge of our control, and while we've been successful at subverting U.S. financial aid, we've also been seduced by it."
Shirani just nodded.
"President Chutani has given me the responsibility of protecting our nuclear arsenal, but ordered me to ignore the external threats from the Americans and Indians, both of whom will stop at nothing to wipe out our capabilities and leave us defenseless."
"How can Pakistan survive this?" Shirani said, finally gaining enough confidence to join the conversation.
"I fear that God is judging our weakness, Ahmed, losing faith in our commitment to his will." "As do I. America's corrupting influence cannot be overestimated."
"Allah be praised." Taj smiled. Shirani's whoring was legendary, and he had been drinking alcohol only moments before. He was like so many others throughout human history, a man who used God as an excuse to pursue his own ambitions. It was this that would eventually make it necessary to get rid of the man. But not yet. In order for chaos to be averted, Taj's coup would have to preserve as much of the existing political structure as possible. The illusion of normalcy was critical in the short term. I assume you're here with a proposal? Shirani said, gaining still more confidence. He would know that whatever Taj had planned, it would be impossible without the consent of the army. Nothing in Pakistan happened without at least the army's pledge not to interfere. Fortunately, the general was a simple man, utterly untrustworthy, but interested first and foremost in protecting his own position.
I will be taking control of Pakistan soon, Taj said simply.
Shirani's surprise at the boldness of the statement was obvious and anticipated. He'd undoubtedly expected to be recruited for some subtle plan to undermine the civilian government's authority, not an admission that an ISI coup was in the works. The general laughed uncomfortably, undoubtedly concerned that this was a trap constructed by Saad Chutani.
You're talking treason, Amit. I have disagreements with the president's relationship with America, but it's my job to tell him my opinion and then obey his orders. I admire your sense of duty, Umar. But how much longer will you be able to hold on to that job? You're experienced enough to know that Chutani is maneuvering to remove you as head of the army.
I know of no such thing. It was Taj's turn to laugh.
I assume you remember what happened to my predecessor.
It was impossible to forget. He had been marginalized with fabricated scandals publicized in media outlets beholden to Chutani. The unrest in North Waziristan had been laid at his feet, and he was vilified every time there was a terrorist attack within Pakistan's borders. Finally, he'd been forced out over accepting bribes that were no different than ones taken by every government executive in the country. He was now facing a lifetime of prosecutions that would leave him penniless and his family disgraced.
We're at a turning point, Umar. The Middle East is disintegrating. The world is ready, in fact, desperate, for a Muslim superpower to fill the vacuum created by the Americans. The Saudis are children obsessed with toys, and the Iranians are backstabbing women with no nuclear capability. Pakistan is the only country capable of becoming that superpower. We have a unique opportunity, Umar. We can neutralize America, take control of the region, and close our fist around the oil they rely so heavily on. We can bring their economy to its knees and stop the drone attacks on our soil. The humiliations can be brought to an end. All we need is our own strength and Allah's blessing.
Taj fell silent and leaned back in his chair. It was Shirani's turn to speak.
What is my position in all this?
Predictably, his thoughts immediately turned to himself.
Under my leadership, you will retain your rank as well as the authority to do what needs to be done with our nuclear arsenal.
And what is that?
The expansion and modernization of our missile technology. Like you, I understand the importance of having weapons capable of reaching the United States.
He paused and allowed himself a smile.
I'm sure America's Congress will be willing to finance the effort.
For the first time, there was a flicker of interest in Shirani's eyes. Self-interest, no doubt, but Taj wasn't naive. No matter what the general promised by way of support, his army would in fact stay as neutral as possible. The general would wait to see who won and then determine whether the power struggle had been bloody enough to make the victor vulnerable. And that was all Taj needed, for the army to remain docile until he could do away with President Chutani and consolidate his leadership. Then, and only then, would he move to deal with Umar Shirani. Chapter 19. Near Lake Constance, Switzerland. Mitch Rapp made a show of activating his throat mic, though in fact he was constantly transmitting on the frequency Gould had been excluded from.
Joe, have you acquired us?
Not yet.
That was probably a good thing. Maslick was in an elevated position specifically looking for them and hadn't yet picked them up. If that was the case, it was almost certain that Obrecht's men were still completely ignorant of what was going on outside their wall. The trip from the knoll had taken longer than Wicker's estimate, but Rapp had anticipated that. Gould was good, making no mistakes that Rapp could see from his position 5 feet behind. He wasn't fast, though. The assassin had been operating primarily in urban environments since he'd left the French Foreign Legion. It was no surprise that he couldn't hold the pace expected by an elfin former SEAL who had been creeping around the woods since he was in diapers. Gould wriggled between two trees and Rapp followed, thoughts of Anna intruding on his mind. Her courage during the White House op, the depth of her green eyes. How different his life would be if she had lived. He cleared the trees and the bottom of Gould's boot came into view again. What Rapp saw, though, was the whitewashed front of the man's house in New Zealand and the sun reflecting off the ocean below. It was a stark contrast to the dilapidated apartment Rapp called home. He'd been building a new house on a couple of acres just outside the Beltway when Anna died. Or, more precisely, when the man in front of him had murdered her in a botched attempt to get to him. Construction had immediately stopped, along with everything else in his life. The burned-out bones of his old house were still there. Kennedy and Mike Nash had tried to convince him to have the lot cleared so it could be sold, but so far he hadn't been able to bring himself to do it. In light of all that, why did he still feel conflicted about Louis Gould? Why had he passed up every opportunity to take the man out? Tom Lewis, the CIA's shrink, had gently suggested an answer. When Rapp looked into the Frenchman's eyes, he saw a reflection of himself. Of course, he'd dismissed it as psychobabble, but there was no denying that Lewis was right more than he was wrong. A small rock outcropping appeared ahead, and Rapp took cover behind it. The entrance to the tunnel was just a few yards away, but they were the most exposed of the journey. "Joe," Rapp said into his radio, "I'm at the feature we designated Echo 3. Look 6 feet behind it." He put a boot against a sapling and gave it a gentle nudge.
"I got you,"
Maslick came back immediately. "Any activity nearby?"
"A nice 6-point buck about 125 to the west, that's it."
Rapp started out again, using his elbows to drag himself forward at a pace that would allow him to close the gap to Gould. The light breeze was traveling from west to east, making it unlikely that the deer would be spooked by their scent. It took an excruciatingly long time to cover the distance, but finally both men were lying in front of the cave's entrance. Gould slid through the tight opening, and Rapp put his head partially inside to let his eyes adjust to the lower light. The Frenchman pried a piece of stone from the dirt wall, revealing the promised keypad. He glanced back before punching in the code.
"Keep your fingers crossed."
Rapp counted, confirming that the string of numbers was the 12 Gould had reported back at the farm. Not that he thought a pathological liar like him would make such an obvious mistake, but it made sense to keep close tabs on the man. There was a quiet click, and Gould pressed a hand against the rusted steel at the back of the cavern. It swung inward, revealing dim, red emergency lighting beyond. Rapp adjusted Hurley's Kimber 45, holstered in the small of his back, and activated his radio again. "We're about to enter. Figure 10 minutes to get to the mansion."
"Roger that,"
Coleman responded.
"Stan?"
Rapp said. The muttered response was barely intelligible.
"Waiting, waiting, and more waiting."
It wasn't what Rapp wanted to hear. They needed Hurley to pinpoint Obrecht's location in the building. A room-by-room search was not part of their quick-in, quick-out plan.
"Roger that. Do what you can, Stan. We're moving."
Chapter 20. Rome, Italy. Once again, Allah had blessed their enterprise. Despite a forecast for rain, the sun was in full force, with only a few distant clouds to obscure it. Kabir Gadai strolled casually along the gravel walkway, led by a leashed Labrador Retriever puppy. He'd purchased it only a few hours ago, and was already looking forward to putting its dead body in a dumpster as soon as this was over. Westerners' affinity for these filthy creatures was inexplicable, but not acknowledging that affinity would be stupid. Nearly everyone who passed looked down at the animal and smiled. More important, Isabella Accorso had 2 Labradors of her own, the latest in an unbroken series of similar dogs going back to her childhood. The park was long and narrow, bordered on the left by a busy Roman road and on the right by the ongoing excavation of an ancient square. Gaddai examined the columns and crumbling walls that recalled a time when the Italians ruled the known world. Later, Catholicism would take hold, and the people of this region would embark on the Crusades, a genocidal rampage against the followers of Muhammad. The same people who are now so critical of violence had burned his people at the stake, imprisoned them in unimaginably cruel conditions, and forced them to endure tortures unparalleled in their creativity and savageness. Now the Americans were sending their Christian soldiers marching across the Middle East in an effort to remake it in the name of a false faith that they themselves seemed largely uninterested in. They would never understand what it was to have God in one's heart, for him to be part of their very being. For the Americans, the Creator was nothing more than an occasional convenience, a being to be called on in difficult times and to be briefly acknowledged on public holidays. ETA 1 minute, the voice said over his Bluetooth headset. Her preferred position is fully open. Gaddai acknowledged the message with a barely perceptible nod. Conveniently, Accorso ate lunch at the same time as her daughter. On clear days like this one, she left her office at noon and came to this park to eat a sandwich brought from home. There were multiple benches to choose from, but she was biased toward the one closest to her building. If it wasn't available, she would select the next in line. Her daughter, Bianca, was even more predictable. She sat on the same low concrete wall at the front of her school every day. In the time they'd been watching her, even the order of the people she ate with hadn't varied. An example of the inviolable social hierarchy that all adolescents adhered to. He spotted the blonde hair and dark coat of his target just as the puppy found something of interest at the base of a garbage can. His first instinct was to jerk the animal away, but instead he paused until it was ready to move on. The bench Accorso had selected was visible to him now, and it was still completely empty. Again, Allah had blessed him. He started toward her, setting his pace so that they would reach the bench at the same time. "Oh, I'm sorry," Gaddai said, stopping in front of it. "Were you going to sit here?" Fortunately, Accorso spoke fluent English, a prerequisite for her job administering contracts and trusts for her law firm. Like the others, she barely noticed him, instead beaming at the dog. "What's his name?" "Her, actually, and I don't know yet. She's just puppy for now." "I was going to eat lunch," she said, pointing at the bench. "Feel free to join me. There's plenty of room."
"That's very kind of you."
They both sat and she leaned forward, rubbing the excited dog's head. It nipped at her leg, and instead of pulling back, she laughed. "I have two just like her at home. Older now, though. You forget how cute they are at this age. Like children." It was all going exactly as planned. While he'd always been quite successful with women, striking up a conversation with one on a park bench was an unpredictable enterprise. If the attention was unwelcome, their interaction could cause her to move on. Or worse, it could attract the notice of people walking past. The animal solved all those issues. "Here," Gaddai said, pulling out his phone, "let me show you something." The woman assumed he was going to show her a photo of the puppy and frowned when the screen came to life.
"I'm sorry, what is that?"
He leaned into her so he could speak quietly.
"It's a video of your daughter Bianca, taken through a rifle scope." She froze, her expression turning from confusion to recognition and then to terror. "Smile," Gaddai said, slipping the phone back in his jacket.
She began to stammer like some half-wit, and he leaned into her ear again.
"I said smile."
She forced the corners of her mouth upward, still trying to get intelligible words out.
What?
"Be silent, and listen to me very carefully. I have no desire to see your daughter harmed. It can only attract attention to me and my people. Whether she lives her life never knowing this happened or dies today is entirely up to you."
"But what do you want? I don't have—"
"Silence," he said in a sharp whisper.
Still, the people passing by paid little attention. To the degree anyone looked in their direction, it was to admire the dog playfully attacking Accorso's shoe.
"Your firm administers a set of files I'm interested in."
"We administer many files. How—"
"This particular client would have made an unusual request.
He would have asked you to send files out over the Internet in the event you didn't hear from him on a particular schedule.
She didn't respond, but the subtle shift in her expression told him everything he needed to know.
You're familiar with this arrangement?
Yes.
Then return to your office. Load the files and any instructions you were given onto a thumb drive.
Thumb drive, she repeated numbly.
That's right, Isabella. You're doing well. This will all be over soon.
He pointed to a hotel across the street.
Bring the files to me there, room 200. It's an easy number to remember. Repeat it back to me.
200.
Very good. Do it quickly, Isabella. Your daughter's break from class won't last much longer, and my man has orders not to let her out of his sight. If I don't call him off by the time she gets up to go back to class, he will kill her. Do you understand?
The woman's eyes were fixed, and a tear had formed in the corner of one of them, but she managed to nod.
Then go.
She broke from her trance and stood, walking unsteadily toward her law firm's building. The dog bounded after her, but Godai gripped the leash firmly. He too would have liked to follow. The uncertainty, and indeed danger, of sending her back to her office unaccompanied was an unacceptable risk in his opinion. But Taj's orders had been clear. After a few more moments he rose, glancing at his watch. Just enough time to get rid of the filthy beast before picking up his room key.
Chapter 21 Near Lake Constance, Switzerland.
Scott Coleman came over the top of a rocky outcropping and leaped to the steep slope below. His thighs burned and his heart pounded powerfully in his chest as he half ran, half skidded down 20 yards of loose dirt.
"Approaching your position," he said, making sure he didn't sound out of breath.
Despite a training program designed and monitored by a soulless Norwegian coach, he was feeling the relentless grade and the weight of his pack. The passage of time was hard on men in his profession. Better than the alternative, though.
"Roger that, Scott. We were wondering what had happened to you."
One of Wicker's veiled jabs. See how he felt when he was pushing 50. The clearing he entered was probably only 30 feet in diameter, bordered with dense trees choked with even denser bushes. McGraw was in a tree on the north side, barely visible in camouflage fatigues and hat. He was holding the modified hunting rifle that he preferred for shorter ranges, scanning through a Schmidt and Bender scope.
"What have you got, Bruno?"
"Garbage."
Coleman moved toward the east side of the clearing, stopping when he caught a glimpse of the gray wall surrounding Obrecht's property. After carefully moving a few leafy branches, he got an unobstructed view of what McGraw was talking about. They were stuck in a trough between hills. From Coleman's position on the ground, nothing more than the wall and the top of the mansion's roof was visible. The gate was a complete write-off, too far south for even McGraw to see.
"Do you have a view into the courtyard?"
"Barely."
"How many guards do you have eyes on?"
"I'm down to two, intermittent."
Coleman swore under his breath and pulled out a rangefinder. Just over 450 yards to the wall. To make matters worse, if that was even possible, they were no longer blocked from the wind. The gentle right-to-left breeze they'd had on top of the knoll was now being accelerated to 8 knots as it funneled through a canyon to the east. To say their new position was a tactical disaster would be the understatement of the century. He might as well have brought a cooler and some beach chairs, for all the use they would be stuck in this hole.
"Can you hit either of them?" Coleman said. 80-20. It's starting to gust." "Wick?"
He knew roughly where his top sniper was, but didn't bother to look for him. Wicker had a custom-built tree stand, with telescoping arms painted and textured to look like tree branches even from a few feet away. His camo was modified with fabric leaves and real bark that perfectly matched the tree species he was in. Even his rifle would have been custom-painted for this particular contract.
"I've got a little more height than Bruno, but I've set up to prioritize my line of sight on our former position. I might be able to take one guard. Depends on timing, though. I'm maybe 30%.
Coleman pulled back to the center of the clearing and began emptying his pack. Best-case scenario, his guys would leave 9 highly trained men and no less than 200 yards of wide-open ground before they hit 12 feet of dead, smooth wall. He hated this plan even more now than when Rapp had first proposed it. There was nothing he could have done to change it, though. He was comfortable arguing with Kennedy and would even mix it up with Hurley from time to time. Rapp was a different animal. Fighting with him was like taking a swing at a hornet's nest. You weren't going to win, and in the process of losing, you were going to be in for a world of hurt. He pulled a small monitor from his pack and turned it on, waiting for the screen to brighten sufficiently to see in the outdoor environment. The image was being beamed from the drone Marcus Dumont had doing lazy figure eights above. The security detail was still on high alert inside the courtyard, but nothing in the rhythm of their activities suggested they knew about the storm gathering on their perimeter. He activated his throat mic, keeping an eye on the image of the men he might soon be up against.
"Are you still dead in the water, Stan?"
"Mm-hmm."
Coleman set the monitor down and pulled his rifle from its case. Outstanding. He had a cancer-ridden old man, cooling his heels in a waiting room, two snipers stuck in the low ground, and Mitch Rapp crawling through a tunnel with the contract killer who murdered his family. Just another glorious day in the service of the Central Intelligence Agency. Chapter 22 Stan Hurley had chosen a hard, straight-backed chair in the corner over the more comfortable furniture placed throughout the parlor. Its position made a shot at him through the reportedly bulletproof windows impossible, while allowing him to keep his back to the wall. Those were only side benefits, though. In a life that had been lived with no compromises, now compromises were all he had. If he stayed on his feet and walked around the room, his recently replaced hip would start to ache. If he sat in one of the heavily cushioned chairs, he was in danger of falling asleep. And if he sat too long where he was, his knees would start to stiffen up. Despite the fact that the main purpose of the CIA was gathering intelligence, no one there knew exactly how old he was. His birth on his parents' kitchen table had left no written record, and the last witness to that event, his older brother, had died earlier that year. In fact, Hurley had just turned 80. The things he'd experienced over his lifetime astounded even him. Horse-drawn carts in the streets of Bowling Green, Kentucky. Collecting scrap metal with the other kids to support the war effort in Europe. The rise of the Soviet Union, his old friend Neil Armstrong planting an American flag on the moon. And Mitch Rapp. Hurley had done everything in his power, and a few things that were most definitely not, to wash the kid out. In the end, the only thing he succeeded in doing was burning out a bunch of the top special ops guys that made up the rest of Rapp's training class. Things that would have killed the average Army Ranger just made that little pissant stick his middle finger in the air. On one hand, Rapp still had a way of getting under his skin like no one else. On the other, it was comforting to know that he was leaving Kennedy with someone who would always protect her, always protect the country that had given them so much. Hurley stood, subconsciously running through the list of physical ailments that could compromise the op if it got hot. After 15 or so, he gave up and pulled a Camel from the pack in his jacket. He held a lighter to the innocent-looking white cylinder and inhaled a lungful of smoke. Over the years, he'd been shot, stabbed, garroted, thrown from a ship 100 miles from shore, and poisoned. The last by a cute little Czech woman he was screwing. Kind of funny that the Grim Reaper had ditched his scythe and snuck up behind him with a tobacco leaf. Just another limp dick in a robe. He started looking around the room again, getting the blood flowing as he walked. No update from Rapp yet. He was probably still in the tunnel. When he got out and found that the target hadn't been located, he wasn't going to be happy. Not that anyone would blame Hurley, but that didn't matter. This wasn't a business of excuses. You either got the job done or you didn't. So, what now? The guard would be standing just outside the closed door, making it impossible for Hurley to simply wander out and play the befuddled old man if he came across anyone. He might be able to bash the man's head in with one of the room's antique knick-knacks, but the chance of that compromising the op was nearly 100%. Hurley felt an all-too-familiar constriction in his lungs and put a handkerchief to his mouth, coughing uncontrollably into it. About halfway through his fit, the door opened, and the guard who had led him there appeared. The good news was the desperate hacking would play into his cover as a helpless geriatric. The bad news was that it wasn't an act. Hurley really was struggling to keep from collapsing, and the handkerchief really was spattered with bloody specks of what had once been his lungs.
"Mr. Obrecht will see you now," the guard said,
apparently unconcerned about the man choking in front of him. Hurley wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and walked unsteadily toward the door.
"Thank you."
"Second floor," the guard said, falling in a pace behind.
Hurley suppressed a smile as he headed for a broad set of steps supported by marble pillars. The timing would be perfect. When Rapp and the frog came out of that tunnel, he'd already have Obrecht wrapped up like a birthday present. A skylight in the domed ceiling threw a shadow, and Hurley kept his eye on the guards as they began to ascend. The man was three steps back, with his assault rifle held against his chest. The image got increasingly dim as they ascended, but not so dim that Hurley didn't see the rifle suddenly begin to rise. He spun, lunging for the man just as the plastic butt caught him in the side of the head. The blow dazed him, but his momentum was still sufficient to send them both toppling down the steps. When they hit the landing, Hurley's head was swimming, and it felt like someone had jammed a hot knife in his hip joint. The other man had come through the fall in much better condition. Protected from the steps by his body armor and youth, he was on his feet before Hurley could even get to his knees. This time, when the rifle butt came down, there was nothing he could do. Chapter 23. The emergency lights bathed everything in red as Rapp pulled himself through the tunnel using his elbows. After a reasonably spacious entrance, the shaft had shrunk down to a cramped 3 feet wide by 2 feet high. Rapp had suffered from mild claustrophobia since he was a kid. Years of fighting in the open spaces of America and the Middle East had made it worse for good reason. The speed, endurance, and accuracy that gave him his edge tended to be neutralized in these environments. The fact that Gould's feet were close enough to his face that he could smell the rubber soles offered some comfort. If anyone discovered them and hosed down the tunnel from the mansion side, the Frenchman would act as a reluctant shield. Even more important, the shaft was too tight for Gould to turn on him.
"I think I see it," the Frenchman said, his whisper echoing through the narrow space. 20 meters.
Rapp's grip on his Glock tightened as they continued forward to a steel wall covered in surface rust. They found a keypad similar to the one at the tunnel's entrance, and Gould punched in another lengthy code. There was a moment of tense silence, followed by the hum of an electric motor. Rapp lowered the night vision goggle mounted to his helmet and flipped it on. The next generation system combined the light amplification of traditional starlight scopes with thermal imaging. Normally, he'd have refused it due to the bulk and weight, but there were enough unknowns about the basement they were about to enter to make it worthwhile. Tests at the farm suggested the unit would give him a solid view of the ambient environment while highlighting the body heat of human targets.
"You ready, Mitch?"
"Go." Gould shoved the steel barrier outward and threw himself to the dirt floor on the other side. He rolled smoothly to the right while Rapp went left as planned. The light amplification capability of the goggle was barely functional due to the depth of the darkness. Thermal picked up a little temperature variation, but other than Gould glowing orange, most everything just read as hazy shades of green. Rapp had to move far slower than he would have liked, avoiding the unidentifiable clutter on his way to an overturned barrel. Gould nearly tripped, but managed to save it and take cover behind something that looked vaguely like an ancient winepress. Rapp spotted a reddish smear at the edge of his peripheral vision, but didn't bother tracking it. Most likely a rat. Other than that, nothing. No sound. No movement. In fact, nothing that would suggest anyone had been down there in years. Rapp swept his gun over a dark hole in the wall that he guessed was a medieval well and then slipped around the left side of the barrel. He motioned Gould forward, and the Frenchman moved cautiously to a low pile of rubble. They leapfrogged that way, moving purposefully until they found themselves at the base of the staircase that led up to the main house. Gould pointed right to a rectangle in the wall that their goggles shaded blue, the cold steel of the entrance to Obrecht's safe room. Rapp covered the Frenchman as he ran to it and smeared a bead of epoxy into the narrow gap between the edge of the door and the jamb. Not exactly high-tech, but it would be enough to keep the Swiss banker from gaining access should things go south. Obrecht's only option at that point would be the tunnel, where he would flee right into the welcoming arms of Joe Maslick. Gould returned and led up the stairs with Rapp a few steps behind. They retracted their goggles and removed their helmets when the light bleeding around the basement door became strong enough for them to see. Rapp stowed their helmets beneath a stack of stained towels on the landing, while the Frenchman slid a fiber-optic cable beneath the door. The image from the tiny camera read out on his phone, displaying exactly what they'd hoped to see, an empty hallway. Rapp activated his throat mic and spoke quietly. "We're exiting the basement under the first floor. Stan, give me a sit-rep." No response. It was one of the unavoidable drawbacks to their plan. His silence could mean that he was dead and that they were walking into an ambush, or it could mean that he was with Obrecht and not in a position to respond. "Scott, update. Stan got called in to meet with Obrecht while you were offline. No communication from him since. We're in position and ready to go." "Roger that. Stan, if you can hear this and you're in Obrecht's office, try to toggle your mic." He waited for a moment, and then the banker's accented voice came over his earpiece. "I've had my people check on this, and I can assure you that my bank does not—" The feed went dead, and Rapp gave Gould a thumbs up. Hurley was where he was supposed to be, but couldn't communicate beyond briefly pressing the button on his key fob. Gould eased the door open and slipped through, with Rapp following. The main staircase was to their left, but it was the centerpiece of the mansion's entry hall and in full view of no fewer than six windows. They went right, skirting the kitchen and entering a narrow servant's staircase. Gould aimed his Glock upward as they ascended, with Rapp keeping an eye on their flank. When they came to the door at the top, Gould did another quick search with the fiber-optic camera and then went through. They were halfway up the wide hallway when they heard a woman's voice singing quietly. The two men ducked into a bedroom and pressed their backs against the wall behind the half-open door. Of all the rooms in the mansion she could have chosen to clean that day, she picked that one. Rapp grabbed Gould's wrist when the assassin aimed his silenced pistol at the back of her head. While the proliferation of surveillance cameras throughout the world was a serious drawback for men in their profession, the invention of the iPod almost made up for it. Rapp spotted the ubiquitous white earphones and motioned toward the hallway. She never noticed the two armed men slipping out of the room only a few feet behind her, concentrating instead on the sheets she was unfolding and the latest dance track from Madonna. They were able to pick up their pace on the thick carpet, and it took only seconds to reach the second-to-last door on the right. According to Gould, Leo Obrecht's office was just beyond. Rapp put an ear to the wall, but it was too thick to hear anything inside. Hopefully they'd find Obrecht and Hurley having a pleasant conversation over tea. A set of flex cuffs and some duct tape would be all it would take to get their package ready to go back through the tunnel. Next stop, a CIA black site in Bulgaria. Rapp put a hand on the knob and nodded a silent three count. He didn't throw open the door like he normally would, instead pushing it gently enough that Obrecht wouldn't get spooked if he saw it. Luck was with him. They slipped inside the study unnoticed, the book-lined walls and tapestries absorbing what little sound they made. At the far side, a heavy-set man with his back to them was poking at the embers in a massive stone fireplace. A modern steel sculpture partially obscured both him and a portion of the right side of the room, but not enough that Rapp couldn't immediately determine that Hurley wasn't there. The man at the fireplace was the size Rapp expected from the surveillance photos, and he had the right expensive suit and short-cropped gray hair. But there was something about him that seemed off. The barely perceptible athleticism in the way he stood. The effortless way he handled the heavy iron poker. Rapp spun toward Gould, but was just a fraction of a second too slow. The Frenchman swept a foot low, taking Rapp's legs out from under him. He hit the carpet rolling, just as the man near the fireplace spun around to reveal the MP5 in his free hand. The sculpture obscured his head, but Rapp resisted the urge to go for a body shot. He knew instinctively that the man's bulk was the result of full body armor. It was a perfect way to imitate an overweight banker while making him impervious to small arms fire. There was a weakness in the mercenary's preparations, though, his expensive Italian shoes. Rapp fired a round into the left one and used his momentum to swing his Glock toward Gould. "Don't do it, Mitch." The assassin had his own pistol lined up in a two-handed grip, and while Rapp could no longer see the murk behind him, The silence suggested he hadn't fallen. If he was tough and disciplined enough to stay upright with the ball of his foot missing, it was likely that the MP5 was also on target. "Drop the weapon, Mitch, and don't get your hands anywhere near that throat mic." Rapp let the Glock fall to the carpet. "And stands." He reached for Hurley's Kimber gold match as he slowly stood. "You've got two guns trained on you, Mitch, and neither one of us are the illiterate goat herders you're used to, understand?" "There's no way Obrecht can be paying you enough for this," Rapp said, retrieving the Kimber and then letting it fall from his hand. $15 million and a new identity so clean even the CIA won't be able to track me. But it's not the money." "What then?" Rapp said, though he already knew the answer. The truth was, he always had. "You're my only failure, Mitch. I thought I'd forget about it as time went on, but it just got worse." He eased left to put himself in a position that would allow him to avoid a crossfire if Rapp made a move. "I had you dead to rights in Afghanistan. I can't believe the idiot who hired me blew it like that. What about your wife and daughter, Louis? How do they fit in with your new identity?" It took Gould a few seconds to respond. "Seemed like a fair trade. I lose them, but I become the man who killed a legend." The door opened, but it didn't even cause a flicker of distraction in Gould. He kept his eyes locked on target as Stan Hurley was pushed through. The old man staggered and nearly fell, holding the back of his head with a blood-soaked hand. "Stan," the Frenchman said cheerfully, "you're just in time to be the icing on my cake." Chapter 24. Rome, Italy. Kabir Gadai checked his phone and then laid it back on the table. The screen continued to display Isabella Accorso's daughter in the crosshairs, as it had for the last 40 minutes. He felt the unaccustomed sensation of nervousness spreading from his stomach to his extremities, producing a barely perceptible tremor in his hands. The life he'd led was one of careful plans, rewarded with an uninterrupted string of successes. This situation, though, had been beyond his control from the beginning. It was one thing to trust in God, but another to rely on his intervention. Allah might see this as arrogance and punish those involved. Bianca Accorso was a young woman with highly predictable habits, and Gadai was confident that she would remain sitting with her friends for precisely another 17 minutes. Taj was certain that this time wouldn't expire without her mother bringing the files, but it would be idiocy not to plan for a worst-case scenario. A quick return to Pakistan would be the most obvious course of action, but he'd been serving Taj for too long to think that was a viable option. If he arrived without the Rickman files, it would be the beginning of his own destruction. Not immediately, of course. Taj was too subtle for that. But within the year he would find himself accused of treason or assassinated by one of the Taliban loyal to Taj. If Accorso didn't appear in the next 20 minutes, it seemed almost certain that she had contacted the Italian authorities. Gadai would have no choice but to run. He would never be able to return to his country. He would never see his sons again. His life would become nothing more than an endless procession of days consumed with trying to stay ahead of Taj's assassins. His Bluetooth earpiece buzzed, and he pressed the button to pick up the call. "Go ahead." "She's entered the lobby." "Any sign of the police?" "None." Gadai let out a relieved breath and walked across the room to the door. There was no denying that as great as the risks were, the rewards were equally great. A position second only to Taj at the helm of the modern era's first Muslim superpower. He would have a hand in spreading Islam across the globe in a way that had never before been imagined. All while the Americans cowered. Gadai peered through the peephole, looking across the hallway at room 200. It would be over soon, he reassured himself. Taj had once again been right. While terrifying and unpredictable, he was a great man favored by God. "She's exiting the stairway," the voice said over his earpiece. 20 seconds, no other activity. Accorso appeared a few moments later with an envelope under her arm. He watched her from behind as she knocked timidly on the door of the empty room. "Still clear?" he asked. His men were monitoring the parking lot, the lobby, and all points of entry to the second floor. "Yes, sir," Gadai opened the door. Isabella. She spun, fear and surprise playing out across her face. Come in, he said, keeping his words purposely vague. If she was wearing a wire, the police would assume he was in room 200 instead of being across the hall. The woman did as she was told, and he closed the door behind her. Have you brought me what I asked for? She gave a short nod and held out the envelope. Gadai sat at a desk that he'd moved away from the draped window and tore open the flap. He inserted the thumb drive he found into his laptop and began perusing the accompanying single page of paper while it loaded. The written instructions were somewhat more complex than he'd expected. Files were individually designated, and various scenarios were laid out, each with a different release schedule. You're following the second scenario? Gadai asked. Okorso nodded, perspiration beginning to form on her upper lip. We were informed that Akhtar Durrani died by an authenticated email when we didn't hear from the client. We released file D6 on the 3rd of the month. He nodded noncommittally. It would have contained the information on the Russian mole in Istanbul. The next file to be released, designated R12, was scheduled for Thursday. What revelations did it contain? The identity of a highly placed informant? A list of bribes to foreign officials? Evidence of wrongdoing by the CIA's administration? It was impossible not to speculate. And by released, you mean you simply sent it to the email address in the instructions? Yes. Have you looked at the files? They're encrypted. Do you know who the client is? He's anonymous. He contacts me by phone once per week and gives me one of the passphrases listed on the instruction sheet. Gadai scrolled through the list of files contained on the thumb drive, feeling a growing sense of elation. They had anticipated 20 or 30. Instead, there were hundreds. How much had Rickman known? What level of access had he enjoyed? Could Taj be right? Could this innocuous data storage device contain the means to the Central Intelligence Agency's destruction? Do you have backups of this information? Yes. In the office of the attorney who handles this client? What about my daughter? You said... I said she wouldn't be harmed if you did as I asked. But you're not answering my questions, are you, Isabella? He saw the ripple in her cheeks as her jaw clenched in anger, but it was a pathetic display. She was nothing more than a frightened woman who couldn't even hold on to her husband. She would do what she was told. Are the backups in the lawyer's office? Gadai repeated. Tell me quickly, your daughter doesn't have much time left. No, Okorso said finally. He may still have the original of the paper instructions, because his secretary made this copy for me. The files are contained on the firm's central computer. It's backed up every night. Gadai looked up at her. And do you have a way of deleting those files from both your mainframe and the backups? She didn't answer immediately, and he just stared at her, letting the seconds tick by. Yes, we have a way to do that. Sometimes we have clients who move their business and want their information wiped from our system. That's good, Gadai said calmly. Listen very carefully, Isabella. I want you to eradicate everything about this arrangement from your system. I want it to appear that it never existed. Surprisingly, she shook her head. What happens when the client notifies my firm that the files aren't being sent? What will you do to my daughter then? Gadai smiled reassuringly. There will be no such notification. Your client is dead. Forget any of this ever happened, Isabella. When the backups are deleted, your job and your daughter will both be safe. Of course it was a lie. He couldn't leave the woman alive. But his words had the intended effect, and she relaxed slightly. Go back to work, he said. Tonight have a glass of wine. Spend some time with Bianca. I promise you'll never hear from me again. Once you've done what I ask, it will be over. Chapter 25. Near Lake Constance, Switzerland. Drop the weapon, Mitch, and don't get your hands anywhere near that throat mic, Gould said. Charlie Wicker slid forward in the tree stand and sighted through his scope. Rapp had modified his radio to constantly transmit on the frequency Gould had been excluded from. For good reason, it seemed. Up to that moment, Wicker shared Coleman's take on this up. Gould had crossed Mitch Rapp as bad as anyone ever could, and was still breathing. If Wicker had been in the Frenchman's position, he'd have fallen to his knees, thanked Jesus, and slunk away to the far corners of the earth in case Rapp ever changed his mind. This psycho just didn't get it.
"We're copying this, Mitch," Coleman's voice over the comm.
Through his scope, Wicker had a good view of the knoll they'd abandoned. The wind was blowing gently along it, causing the tall grass to wave rhythmically. About halfway up, something caught his eye, a patch that wasn't swaying to the same music as the rest.
"I have movement," he said into his throat mic.
It was the reason they'd surrendered the high ground for this tactical and literal hole. Anyone planning an assault on Obrecht's property would want to take advantage of that knoll, but Gould's anxiousness to put them up there had made Rapp suspicious. He'd expected a betrayal, and that was exactly what he was getting. A camo-covered arm came into view at the bottom of his scope image, and then disappeared again.
"Confirmed. One man closing on our former position. I'm guessing there are more just out of sight."
"Can you hit him?" Coleman responded. If he had his Barrett, it would be no problem. That kind of artillery was impossible to handle in the stand, though. That left him with his M-39. An excellent weapon, but not exactly built for these kinds of ranges.
"Real low percentage, Scott."
Scott Coleman glanced skyward, but couldn't see the man in the tree above. When Wicker said low percentage, it meant virtually impossible for the best shooters on the planet. In the years they'd worked together, though, the diminutive SEAL had rarely missed.
"You're my only failure, Mitch. I thought I'd forget about it as time went on. But it just got worse."
Coleman ignored Gould's voice over the radio and activated his throat mic again.
"What have you got, Bruno?"
"The guards are playing it cool, but they've all pulled back behind the wall. I have no targets."
"Stan, you're just in time to be the icing on my cake."
Coleman confirmed McGraw's report with the video being beamed from Dumont's drone. There was no more time to screw around.
"Wick, take the shot. If you can't hit him, get close enough to put the fear of God into him."
When those mercs made it to the top of the knoll and found no one, it wouldn't take them long to locate his team's tracks and descend on them. On the other hand, if they lost the element of surprise and found themselves under fire by an unseen sniper, they might retreat. Mercenaries tended to like to push things only so far. It was hard to cash checks with half your head missing. The familiar puff of Wicker's silenced rifle sounded, and Coleman glanced pointlessly up into the tree again.
"Report."
"I think I winged him,"
Wicker said, sounding genuinely surprised.
"Yeah, confirmed. I have blood on the grass. He's still moving, though. Do you want me to try to finish him?"
"Negative. Let him bleed."
A wounded soldier was almost always more damaging than a dead one. If the injury was serious, he might panic or start screaming in pain. Two things that could quickly demoralize the most battle-hardened unit. Even if he held it together, his comrades would have to evaluate how bad he was and whether they were going to leave him or attempt a rescue.
"No new targets, and the wounded man has taken cover," Wicker said. "They're good, no question of that."
Coleman nodded silently. It's exactly how his team would have reacted. Go still, evaluate the situation, and try to ID the sniper.
"If you get another reasonable target, take the shot. Hurt him bad, but try not to kill him. Let's give them something other than us to deal with."
"Roger that."
"Bruno?"
"Still nothing."
Coleman returned to his pack and unstrapped the small rocket launcher secured to its side. This particular unit fired a prototype thermobaric projectile that had been heavy as hell to carry but was guaranteed to make an impression. Its developer at Raytheon had actually laughed out loud when he'd been asked if it could penetrate a reinforced cinder block wall. Gould was still talking, but Coleman turned him out and activated his mic again.
"Mitch, Stan, if you can hear this, get ready. Things are about to get a lot less subtle."
Chapter 26. ISI Headquarters, Islamabad, Pakistan. Senator Carl Ferris and his entourage all rose to their feet when Taj entered the outer office. The American politician strode toward the smaller man, enveloping his hand and smiling broadly.
Good to see you, Ahmed. It's been a long time.
Too long, sir. I'm honored that you took time out of your schedule to meet with me personally.
Deciding which chair Sunny Wicker's ass is in while she drones on about our new aid package isn't much of a priority for me.
The program to be announced at next week's state dinner was yet another example of the bribes that the Americans believed would keep Pakistan docile. Not that Taj objected to the influx of Western money. He would see to it that only a tiny portion of that $1 billion ever found its way into the hands of Pakistan's poor. The rest would be diverted to the military and the terrorist groups the Americans were so frightened by.
"Please join me in my office, Senator."
Ferris waved at his people to stay where they were and followed the ISI director inside.
"Tea?"
Taj offered.
"I'm on a tight schedule, Ahmed."
"Of course, I understand completely."
Ferris had gained a visible amount of weight and was trying unsuccessfully to hide it with a creatively tailored suit. Undoubtedly, it was the product of stress. The information given to the politician by Akhtar Durrani would have made for an explosive hearing. Endless hours of Ferris hitting Irene Kennedy with specific dates, names, and places while she stammered and equivocated. A bold first step toward his party's presidential nomination. Unfortunately, Durrani was dead, and Kennedy had discovered Ferris's relationship with the former ISI deputy director. She was keeping the information quiet for now, but the public release of evidence linking the prominent senator to Pakistani intelligence had the potential to devastate his political career.
"Let me say,"
Taj started, but Ferris spoke over him.
"Kennedy told me that Durrani kidnapped her man, Joe Rickman, and was torturing him for information, that they're both dead now."
"Irene Kennedy is a professional liar."
"And you're not?"
"I was appointed to this position specifically because I'm not, sir."
Ferris frowned, but there was no skepticism in his expression. Like everyone else, he saw Taj as weak, a pawn to be used and, if necessary, sacrificed.
"So you're saying it's not true?"
"That would be too simple, Senator. Kennedy mixes truth with lies to keep her enemies off balance."
"Is that scotch?"
Ferris said, pointing to a crystal service. Taj had his people bring it in specifically for this meeting.
"It is."
Ferris poured himself a glass uninvited.
"What's your truth, Ahmed?"
"Durrani was little more than a thug. He was not capable of creating a plan this complex. I can assure you that it was entirely Joe Rickman's doing. He had become disillusioned with the CIA in a similar way that you have. He saw it as a corrupt and destructive organization that no longer answered to elected officials like yourself. Unfortunately, he was far more clumsy in his actions than you would have been."
It was untrue to the point of being transparent. Rickman had been a brilliant strategist. He'd spent years devising a plan that had a very real chance of dismantling America's intelligence apparatus. This partisan half-wit would be no more capable of comprehending Rickman's complex machinations than Durrani was. Of course, the senator didn't see it that way and accepted the blatant flattery without a second thought.
"How were they killed?" "Kennedy didn't say what happened to Rickman, and the report said your man had a heart attack."
"They were shot by one of Durrani's men with the help of an anonymous American."
"An American? Are you sure?"
"Yes. We have recordings of his voice. It's impossible to prove because of the poor quality, but we believe it was Mitch Rapp."
Ferris's face twisted with hate, and he stalked around the room for a few moments, processing what he'd heard. Finally, he stopped short.
"That bitch! She made me believe that Durrani had been playing me and murdered Rickman. She said she'd release the emails between us and make me out to be either a traitor or some naive patsy. She threatened to have me arrested. Me!"
"She's afraid of you, Senator. She understands your power and your patriotism, that you won't allow her to subvert everything America stands for."
Despite his lifelong devotion to Allah, this was the first time Taj had been absolutely certain he was seeing God's hand at work. What other explanation could there be? His impending takeover of Pakistan, the Rickman files,
the $1 billion that the Americans were about to transfer into his pocket? And now Allah had delivered this simpleton who had a very real chance at becoming the President of the United States. Ferris swilled from his glass, nostrils flaring with anger.
What do you want to bet that even President Alexander doesn't know about this? That she and Rapp assassinated one of your top people and an American citizen with no authority at all?
I think it's very likely, Taj responded calmly. Men like Ferris, ones with delicate egos that had swelled to these proportions, became almost comically easy to manipulate. Undoubtedly, he told himself that he acted out of a love for his country's pathetic constitution, but that was a lie. The truth was that Irene Kennedy simply hadn't bowed and scraped sufficiently before him. All this was nothing more than the personal vendetta of a feeble little man.
I doubt she had any admissible evidence against Rickman, Taj said. Much more likely he knew too much about her and Rapp, and she needed to silence him. It's just the kind of thing that your committee is set up to prevent, no?
Ferris responded by letting out a long string of expletives.
To change the subject somewhat, Senator, what are your own lawyers saying?
Ferris had the potential to become a very useful tool, but not if he was under Kennedy's thumb. Recently implemented campaign financing rules were easily subverted, and the ISI would be able to quietly funnel as much anonymous money to America's politicians as it pleased. The cycle of corruption was delicious. Taj used American aid to buy American politicians, who then approved more aid in order to increase the amount of money the ISI had to fill their campaign coffers.
The lawyers say I'm on solid ground, Ferris said. As far as they're concerned, a foreign official lodged a confidential complaint about illegal activity by the CIA and I investigated it. The fact that I didn't bring it to the attention of the Intelligence Committee is a procedural issue more than a legal one. I can play it off as being concerned that Senator Lonsdale is in Kennedy's pocket.
Then your problems are solved.
Ferris looked at him like he was a slow child.
Wake up, Ahmed. It's not that simple. Winning a criminal case keeps me out of jail, but fighting it ends my career. I need an army of political consultants to start shaping my message. With the right people, I can come out of this looking like a hero. Those people aren't cheap, though.
But this shouldn't be difficult, Taj said, feigning naivete. You are a hero, Senator. You're protecting your country's freedom.
Ferris laughed.
Truth has nothing to do with American politics, Ahmed. Voters are idiots who do what they're told. I just have to make sure it's me and not that bitch Kennedy who's doing the telling.
Of course I would be happy to contribute to your effort.
I'm glad to hear you say that, Ahmed. 5 million ought to get us off to a good start.
U.S. dollars?
Taj said, eyes widening. In fact, the amount was insignificant. Beyond the money flowing in from the U.S. government, the American people provided hundreds of millions annually by purchasing his Afghan-grown heroin.
Like I said, people like these don't work cheap.
Taj nodded submissively.
You're a good friend to my country and have done nothing but support our efforts to eradicate the terrorist threat. I'll have my people begin preparations immediately.
That's good, Ahmed. Tell them to work quick, okay? I don't trust Irene Kennedy any farther than I can throw her. We need to slap her down, and we need to do it hard and fast.
Of course. But in the meantime, I think there's more I can do to help you. Information you might find useful.
The man's eyebrows rose.
What kind of information?
What if I told you that Rickman is releasing videos damaging to the CIA?
Ferris waved a hand dismissively.
We all saw the video of him being tortured and talking about agency assets, Ahmed. It was on YouTube, for God's sake.
There have been subsequent videos that Kennedy is keeping from your government.
You said Rickman was dead.
He is, but he knew that his life was in jeopardy. He feared that Mitch Rapp would discover that his kidnapping was fake and begin looking for him. Somehow he set up his scheme to survive him.
What's in these videos? Ferris said,
starting to sound interested.
We are only aware of one so far. It resulted in Mitrap killing a number of Russian agents in Istanbul. We anticipate further releases in the future.
A broad smile spread across Ferris's face.
Can we prove it? Perhaps soon. It seems like a story your new image consultants would be interested in, no? Kennedy losing control of Rickman as he flooded Afghan warlords and drug dealers with American money. Sloppy security that allowed him to learn far more than he should have. And you trying desperately to stop it while she blackmails you with lies.
Ferris didn't seem to be listening anymore. His eyes stared blankly past Taj, undoubtedly seeing himself crushing Irene Kennedy and then rising meteorically to the Oval Office. Taj glanced at his watch.
I know you have another commitment in half an hour, Senator, and I fear that traffic will be difficult at this time of day.
That snapped the man out of his trance. He put down his drink and extended a liver-spotted hand.
Good talk, Ahmed.